Now it's time for the Southern Cross with Kendall Hutt.
Yes, and I'm hoping we have Kendall with us right now. Kendall, are you there? No, it appears not. We may have to come back to Kendall and move on to our next segment, which is National and Gangs. So yesterday, National announced a new policy to crack down on meth dealing among gangs. The policy includes a rollout of new police powers, which enable the police to search gang members' properties without a warrant. Police Minister Paula Bennett says drugs such as meth and the gangs that peddle them are a scourge on society. In outlining the policy, Bennett defended the hardline approach taken, saying serious criminals and gang members have fewer human rights than others. Earlier today, Sam spoke to Canterbury University sociologist Jerry Gilbert about the policy. Gilbert says Paula Bennett should resign over it, and he labelled the move cynical and dangerous.
What is your initial reaction to National's new policy?
Well, I think lost in a lot of this noise is there were actually some good elements to the policy. But what has made the front pages, as it were, was the suggestion that we can somehow remove rights of gang members. Now, on face value, people might say, well, who cares, they're only gang members. But, you know, human rights are human rights. We don't get to pick and choose who gets them. In fact, any suggestion that we can, I think, is quite repugnant to the principles that, you know, support our democracy, support our country. So they ought to be seen very, very cynically. And in fact, as something more than that, actually, as something dangerous. And I'm pleased that so many people have come out and called Paula Bennett on that.
Now, part of the policy also includes giving police new powers to search cars and houses of gang members at any time without a warrant. Is this the right way to go about cracking down on crime?
No, it's not. You know, if you replace the term gang member with any other group in society, we would not support the police going in without a warrant to search people's homes. It's a very intrusive power. And it's a tool that we're giving to the police without that judicial oversight, which is currently the case. And so, no, we oughtn't do that. And it concerns me that we are considering doing that in a sort of a sober light, as it were, because we're not often challenged on rights-based issues in easy cases. It's usually a very difficult one. So it concerns me a bit what measures we'll take when we have a genuine crisis, when we are really put under pressure, you know, by, say, a terrorism incident or something. What rights will we begin to remove then if we're so seemingly so willing to sort of do it now?
Would you also say that such measures are an extreme breach of privacy?
Yeah, look, they are. They're going into someone's home, you know, it's their sanctuary, isn't it? I mean, I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah.
And just because you're a member of a gang doesn't remove your right to not have the police come in without a good reason. And these powers would mean that they could come in for any, to search for weapons is the reason given, but without any cause for thinking a crime has been committed at all. They can just wander in and search. We should be very, very mindful of giving police those powers, and in fact we shouldn't do it.
Do police have more powers now in New Zealand compared to a lot of other Western countries?
You know what, I'm actually not sure how we would stand relative. I mean, I think because the Bill of Rights in New Zealand is just common law, we don't have a written constitution as such. Laws that breach rights can in fact be passed in this country, which is quite an odd sort of thing if you think about it. What's the point of having a Bill of Rights Act if it doesn't supersede other law? And obviously the likes of the US, for example, obviously has a written constitution that enshrines rights much more solidly. But when it comes to specific police powers, I must say I'm not sure.
Do you think this has the potential to upset relations between the police and gangs?
Oh, look, it would certainly have that effect. If your policy is to anger and annoy gang members, then this policy would do that, because suddenly you can have the police just coming in and searching your house and your car. Now, again, we may have very little sympathy for gang members, but how they will react when they're targeted unjustly. Most gang members will take a fair cop.
Yeah.
If you're banged to rights, if they're misbehaving and they get caught for that, well, you know, slap the cuffs on and off we go. No one's going to complain about that. But if you're being unjustly searched, and regularly so, quite rightly, that's going to anger people. And I would suggest for no good reason. You know, that's a very poor way to make policy. And remembering, you know, we should be quite used to this in some ways, because every 3 years during an election, gangs come up, don't they? You know, and there are always sort of these policies to put in place to smash the gang. So many of us will just sort of roll our eyes and go, well, here we go again. The difference here is that the measure has gone a step too far. And when the minister is talking about removing people's human rights, and doing so quite happily with a smile on her face, is a problem. And that's where we should all stand up and just take a bit more notice.
How big a problem is meth in the gang community? Because Paula Bennett says that gangs are manufacturing it, are a scourge on society.
And look, that's fair. No one's here to defend meth dealers. But look, I'll put it this way, because context. I think we do need some context around this, because it's so often, and this is politicians. It largely comes from politicians. Are always banging on the gangs, drugs, forgetting the fact that the vast majority of people arrested for dealing methamphetamine aren't in a gang.
Mm.
So, you know, it's so easy to see that, believe that gangs and drugs are synonymous, when in reality, if we could click our fingers tomorrow and shoot every gang member or incarcerate every gang member, the trade in methamphetamine would largely be interrupted. There might be a blip for those gang members who are dealing drugs, but when we have the demand, there'll always be a supply. So I think it's important that we decouple those issues. We should be talking about organised crime and drugs rather than gangs and drugs, because that casts the net sufficiently wide as to be, you know, much more accurate.
Now, what would be the best way then to go about addressing this issue?
Well, look, it's probably a bit trite to say, but if we are genuine in our desire to tackle the meth issue, we have to combat the demand. And so that means educating people away from drugs. From using drugs, particularly methamphetamine, but more so, I think, funding intervention. So when people are addicted to drugs, that there are ways and means that they can get off that easily, and that's not the case at the moment. And the reason why that's important is not just because we don't want addicted citizens, but because addicted citizens will commit more crime, largely to support their habit. And so it's in all of our best interests to tackle that. And remembering, Nationals policy actually had elements of that to it.
Mm.
But unfortunately, that's sort of been forgotten, because they went down the sort of silly politicking road to attempt to garner votes from people who think getting tough on crime is the answer. And unfortunately, there are many people in our community who believe that. So while it might be terrible policy, it's pretty good politics.
To understand the distinction.
Pre-wire.
That was Canterbury University sociologist Jared Gilbert speaking to Sam Smith earlier today.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross with Kendall Hutt.
And we're going to go for the Southern Cross again. Kendall, are you there?
I am indeed.
That's good. Good to hear from you. So leaders of the Pacific Islands Forum are meeting in Apia, Samoa this week, and the human rights situation in West Papua is on the official agenda. But I understand some West Papua action groups have urged the forum to take more action on this issue. So what's happening there?
So last week, several West Papuan action groups issued some open letters to leaders of the Pacific Islands Forum, and one organisation, West Papua Action Auckland, actually sent a letter to every leader. And on Wednesday, Pacific Media Watch reported that the Australian West Papua Association had written an open letter to the Pacific Islands Forum, asking them to take real action rather than just issuing their concerns on the human rights situation in West Papua. They issued several calls or requests, keep raising human rights abuses and keep that pressure on Jakarta to implement a fact-finding mission and ask for the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression to visit West Papua. And Australia West Papua Association actually asked for West Papua to have an official voice within the Pacific Islands Forum. So they wanted the United Liberation Movement for West Papua to have a voice, and they said that if ULMWP had a voice within the Pacific Islands Forum, that the organisation could play an important role in helping to facilitate that dialogue between West Papua and Jakarta. But ultimately, they did say that they were grateful for the support because West Papua Action Auckland has, Australia West Papua Association has said that the Pacific Islands Forum, the Pacific Islands Forum has supported West Papua in the past, in 2015 in Port Moresby and Pompeii in 2016. And West Papua Action Auckland, which is spearheaded by Mari Leadbeater, they also issued similar calls, and that was where the concern came out that the Pacific Island Forum needs to do more than just express concern, and really needs to follow the several Pacific nations who have raised this issue, you know, at the United Nations General Assembly and also the Human Rights Council.
Because previously the West Papua Action Groups and their supporters have kind of gone to the UN when they're raising these concerns. I mean, what is it they hope that the Pacific Islands Forum in particular can achieve in terms of putting pressure on Indonesia?
So the Pacific Islands Forum was originally set up in the 1970s as a trade body, but now it's the primary body for Pacific Island leaders to discuss the political, economic and developmental issues, you know, facing our Pacific region. And West Papua is one of these political and developmental issues. During the 1960s, Indonesia controversially got a hold of West Papua. West Papua allegedly voted through an act of free choice to become part of Indonesia, but many critics say that this was actually an act of no choice. Many of West Papuans who voted were forced to, and the central issue in West Papua is that the people are repressed by the Indonesian government. They don't get to, we don't hear much from the region. As much as President Joko Widodo says that, you know, the media is allowed in, it's still very difficult. And in terms of the Pacific Islands Forum, this is the central place where every leader in the Pacific meets to discuss all of these issues. So it's really important that this is done within the Pacific Islands Forum and then also through United Nations as well, if that answers your question.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess another big issue for the Pacific that will be raised at this forum is climate change. But you've been looking into the role that climate finance plays in kind of adapting to the changes in the region. I mean, first off, what is climate finance?
So climate finance is it's both multilateral and bilateral. So in the Pacific, it's multilateral through organisations like the United Nations, the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and bilateral is between countries. Now, a few years ago, the Pacific wasn't receiving much finance geared towards how to adapt and to mitigate to climate change. But I spoke to Julianne Hickey, the director of Caritas Aotearoa New Zealand, and she said that has now changed. There is a steady flow of finance going into the Pacific. And climate finance is really key here because the level of disasters that the Pacific faces through cyclones, most of their money that they get, or their aid money or their recovery money, is directed towards recovering from cyclones and natural disasters. So with climate finance, it actually funds how the Pacific is adapting and mitigating to climate change. And one of the key aspects is climate change relocation. It's slightly bittersweet because when people have to move from their islands, their communities and their home, they are losing their languages and their identity and their culture somewhat, but it's integral that, and it is critical that this climate finance continues. One of the success stories that I myself personally witnessed was in Fiji with the village of Tukaraki. It was hit by a fatal landslide in 2012 and Cyclone Evan in the same year, and also Cyclone Winston in 2016, and 50% of the village was destroyed, and the village applied to relocate elsewhere, and thankfully that was granted, and thanks to funding from the EU, they now have a whole new community about 10 kilometres away from their original site, and they have 10 new homes. They have a community centre which can withstand a Category 5 cyclone, and they also have a church as well. But as I said before, it is very bittersweet. They said that they are going to miss having access to their crops being sort of right outside their door.
And I think in that same coverage from that trip, you also learned that there were concerns, right, from local government about where the rest of the funding was coming from, because obviously you have all these relocations, right, but the money has to come from somewhere.
Indeed, and it's nice to see that there has been a switch, that funding has increased. The Secretariat of the Pacific Regional Environment Program, they estimate that there are approximately 10 funds, which are both bilateral and multilateral, which are directed towards the Pacific. And these come from bodies such as the EU and the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Here in New Zealand, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade invested $200 million into the Pacific at COP21. That was their promise, which is happening across 4 years. And they also have put in $3 million into the Green Climate Fund. And within that fund itself, 68% of that funding goes towards adaptation and mitigation projects in the Pacific. They currently have 43 projects running, and six of those in the Pacific have gone into places like the Cook Islands, Vanuatu, Fiji, in terms of sustainable future, so renewable energy, and also how you can mitigate climate change, building seawalls, making dams stable, all those sorts of really key projects that the Pacific needs.
All right, well, thanks so much for your time, Kendall, and we look forward to talking with you again next week.
No problem.
That was the Southern Cross.